Capitalism has been a fundamental part of the American story from the very beginning, when the country became a place for people to dream and vent and bet the farm in pursuit of a better life. In the new book, Americana, author Boo Srinivasan explores 400 years of the American spirit of innovation and ambition through a series of next big things, the inventions, techniques, and industries that drove American history forward, from the telegraph, the railroad, guns, and radio, radio, to banking, flight, suburbia, and cell phones. Srinivasan is a media entrepreneur whose career has spanned digital media, pop culture, technology, publishing, and financial content. Again, the name of the book is Americana, a 400-year history of American capitalism. And we welcome Boo Srinivasan to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Great pleasure to have you on the program. This is a big book. You cover a lot. What brought you down the path of wanting to try to get a handle and the ultimate premise of telling this sort of unwieldy story, if you will?
Well, I think a lot of it stems from my own family's arrival in America and our motivations to come to this country. You know, my mother was 34 years old, and she received a postdoctorate position at Roswell Park Memorial Institute in Buffalo, New York. And we tagged along, my brother and I. Was 8 years old and my brother was 4. And obviously we're leaving a democracy in India, so we're not coming to America, leaving everything behind just for a slightly better version of democracy. And so since our own motivations were so economic in nature that we wanted to be able to access the prosperity that you know, we certainly couldn't in India with the ease that you could in America, at least that was the promise, I wanted to trace that back and see how true that was throughout the history of the United States. We tend to think of the traditional conceptions of freedom and liberty as the great allure. And, you know, to some degree, I think that, you know, the prosperity is an allure, equally big allure, if not greater allure. And that's the same case for even people that come from Mexico that cross that border that are undocumented, even at the even for the American underclass. You know, they're leaving the privileges of citizenship in Mexico to come here to live as stateless non-citizens. So obviously that's not a vote for democracy. It's a vote for something else altogether. So I just wanted to explore that further. And that's what drove the curiosity to trace that history back that way.
So in tracing that history back, how far did you want to go back? Your starting point is where, and why did you settle on that?
Well, I think this book was in progress for a long time, and sometimes you would have these discrete elements just pop up, and it would trigger my curiosity. And one of those things was, you know, how did the Pilgrims manage to finance a large ship? You know, if I were to tell you that 100 people in Central America chartered a 737 to come to this country, you would ask, well, how did they get the money to charter a 737? Yet in 1620, you have these religious separatists that that, you know, are persecuted in the American mythology, but they were somehow able to finance a large ship with English financing, permission from the Virginia Company to come here. It got demarcated later on. But, you know, you have a more complicated story than people just quickly overnight fleeing. And when you start going into the financing of the Mayflower, you start seeing a complex financing document with shareholders, with, you know, pro rata distribution rights at the end of 7 years. Eventually those shares get converted into debt. So it's this very sophisticated financing mechanism. And it took 25 years for the financial transaction to really complete itself and go through the process. And ultimately the interests were settled in the 1640s. So I think that those are the types of stories that then start assembling themselves into this larger framework. And I didn't think that you could tell a story of American capitalism without really going back to the Virginia Company. So it really starts at the Virginia Company, and it's a company before it was a colony. And company implies that there's some economic motivation behind it.
As I mentioned in the introduction, this is told through the series of next big things, the inventions and the techniques and the industries that drove this country forward. For you, what was the definition of a next big thing, and what went into compiling and figuring out what that list would contain?
Well, so in 1995, I was fortunate to take a class from the acclaimed historian Richard White, who happens to have a book in the market right now on the Gilded Age, just came out. And in his class, the final assignment was to trace our own family's history and connect it with American history. So we were only here for 11 years, so I had to find some economic themes for that essay. And then soon after that, I saw the internet browser really take hold. We were living in Seattle at the time, where University of Washington is. And you saw the internet just take off, the browser, and you saw these at signs and this .com signs on the side of billboards, on buses, everywhere else, and it just quickly transformed society. And then you see it again, starting in 2007, you saw the smartphone come out, where it's taking the browser and combining that with a cellular telephone, and all of a sudden you have the smartphone, and that then transforms society. So I'm looking at these two very recent next big things as I come in, as I came into adulthood. So I think that those were the things that kind of set the template that, yes, every 10 years you're able to see this, and then you just start going back in time. So this, you know, instead of starting at the beginning, I really started just going back in time and saw where it stopped, and it really just never did. It took you all the way to the Virginia Company.
How subjective is a list like that? I mean, do people say, oh, why didn't you include this or why didn't you include that? Or is it fairly – because I mean, I know when I was reading the books, oh, well, that makes sense. Right, that seems like the next big thing.
Well, I think, I mean, some of it, obviously, some of it is subjective. Some things fall to the cutting room floor. But you're really looking at how transformative certain things are. I don't think that we missed very much. And I think this is not because I'm so clever, but just, it's, you know, some of these things are just very obvious. Oil, obviously. In 1859, Colonel Drake figures out how to drill for oil in Titusville, Pennsylvania. And for the next century, America's the leading oil producer on Earth all the way until the early 70s. So that's an obvious one. And when do you want to focus on the oil industry? I focused on it at the rise of John D. Rockefeller's career in the 1860s and 1870s, when oil was this very cheap illuminant that allowed you to extend the daytime into nighttime so that the American worker had some light in the evening. So you want to look at where it really transformed American life, the way people lived, and it's not just a rah-rah celebration of capitalism. It's really just, you know, what are the actual things that impacted your life? Because people are not always thinking about politics. They're thinking about how to feed themselves, how to live a little bit better, how to live a little bit more comfortably, and those are the things that really consumes people. And any time that consumer behavior changed, it was an easy enough spot for me to find what was that transforming agent.
There are a couple, as I said, it's a big book and there's a lot here. There's just a couple things I want to focus on that I thought of special interest. One is, you make the point in the book that, yeah, it took a long time for women to get the right to vote. Democracy took its time in recognizing women. However, when it comes to capitalism, the understanding of women and the purchases they made for their household, they learned that decades earlier, and it became a very large part of our economy.
Exactly. And that's one of those things where consumerism and capitalism were, to some degree, faster to embrace that women controlled household budgets. So in the 1880s, 1890s, this was very clear. And in fact, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, she, along with her sister, Catherine Beecher, wrote The American Woman's Home, and The American Woman's Home details all of these new consumer products that people can buy instead of having to churn your own butter or sew your own clothes. You can just buy it out of a Sears catalog, and of course, the Sears catalog understands it, and they put women on the cover of their catalogs by the time the late 1890s, and starting in 1900, certainly, women were on the cover, and in fact, there's this one very iconic cover where I think it's the 1905 or the 1906 catalog, where the woman has her arms raised in a way that the Statue of Liberty does, holding the torch, except she's holding money, I think, in her hand. So you see that. You see that consumerism, for a large part, identified and realized that women controlled the purse, if not the vote.
I'm a Philly boy, raised in Philadelphia, and spent a lot of time at John Wanamaker's. You talk about John Wanamaker and the opening of the first department store in the city of brotherly love, and what a contribution that was to the industry.
That's right. And so, and this is one of those things where you would think these opulent department stores, and before the department store, and Wanamaker copied A.T. Stewart, so he was heavily influenced by A.T. Stewart, who had a department store in New York City. And Wanamaker built one much larger than Stewart's. And he built this huge, it was called a Grand Depot originally, because it was the, and he had this big facility. And he was replacing all of these specialized stores where merchants would keep the merchandise behind the counter. The prices wouldn't be transparent. They would continuously ask you questions. There wasn't all that disclosure as to what the goods are. And so Wanamaker changed all that. He was just, fair in pricing. Customers could walk around. So even if you couldn't afford to buy anything, you could wander through this very gilded surroundings, these opulent department stores, and they were quite opulent back then. I mean, so this is, you're looking at, so they almost had a taste for the Gilded Age. So even if you're not quite gilded yourself, it was this accessible luxury that you might just buy a towel or, bed sheets, but you're walking through this this incredible environment. So that did change retail. And Wanamaker also had another contribution in that he eventually ended up the Postmaster General,
right,
which another great Philadelphian, Benjamin Franklin, had served as. And as Postmaster General, Wanamaker instituted or really pushed for rural free delivery, which allowed people in rural communities to get mail dropped at their homes rather than having to go into the village to collect their mail, which was often a cumbersome thing for people to do if they live miles from town.
So telling these stories, what would you like the takeaway to be for readers?
Well, I think the stories themselves are exciting because you see these creative entrepreneurs, layer on and meet consumer demand in so many creative and innovative ways. But on the other hand, I think that the through line of the book is how democracy and political forces and social forces clashed with markets, and the form of American capitalism we have now is really the synthesis. It's not pure free market capitalism on one side, and it's certainly not central planning and communism on the other side, but it's this hybrid system, and how, just like you're advertising in products in the Sears catalog or selling products in the Sears catalog, Sears also used to sell products that would say, here's the cure for cancer, here's a cure for blindness and deafness in 1900. And obviously you needed some form of regulation, otherwise these harmful substances were going to enter people's bodies. So lots of times this book also mirrors the rise of the regulatory state and why some of these institutions came into existence. I go into the chapter on banking in the 30s, and here during the Great Depression, you had all of these social institutions come into play, securities regulation, the FHA, federal backing of home loans, and people tend to question government involvement in economic affairs now, but you have to understand, FDR won 46 out of 48 states in 1936, so after 4 years of his management of the economy, the vast majority of Americans liked what he did to essentially institute shock absorbers for the volatilities and fallouts of American capitalism. So I think it's important for Americans to also understand why Americans in the past had made decisions to build some of these shock absorbers into the system to temper the forces of American capitalism to end up with this hybrid form that we have now.
Boo Srinivasan is the author of Americana, A 400-Year History of American Capitalism. The book is published by Penguin Press. Boo, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.